It's all in the way you look at it. That goes for church, but for people and for everything else, too. You remember seeing the Susan Boyle video on YouTube? Yeah. You remember so many people's reaction to it? I mean, this unemployed 47-year-old matron who came out on stage in a simple house dress and said she wanted to sing professionally. And you saw the smirks and the rolled eyes and Simon, for Simon, very restrained skepticism in his questions. How old are you? What's the dream? And, of course, why hasn't it worked out so far? And then she sang. How often we need to be reminded that what we do not see is still real, because there's always more to learn. That the judgments we make are not always right, because there's always more to learn. That what we think is right often isn't, especially when it comes to other people, because there's always more to learn. And therefore, we shouldn't listen too closely to the stories we tell ourselves, as they did in Susan Boyle's audience with the smirks and the rolled eyes. Because most of the time, God has a surprise waiting for us. Didn't Jesus tell us to have eyes to see and ears to hear? Then shouldn't we still these interior monologues so that we can hear? So that we can see what is real and not just what we want to see, and not hear only what we tell ourselves? Christian, a Christian, a truly alive Christian, will know that he doesn't know what he doesn't know, but will never think that what he doesn't know doesn't matter. Many of us do just that. Not exploring, not learning, not growing, just doing what is socially acceptable and thinking that that's good enough, forgetting what we once knew, that God says that good enough isn't good enough, and that we must pursue him in his truth, that we must run this race, not drift with the current, even a current in a church, that we must love him with all our heart. If we look around us openly, we will see that most people's greatest suffering, the origin and cause of most problems between and in people, is the ignorance of who we really are. My not knowing who I am and my not knowing who you are, multiplied by every person in a conversation, in a room, in a building, in a county, in a state. When we don't know this, we can't see the secret beauty that God has put into each part of his creation. Remember, God hides his love and splendor all over the world, just waiting for us to find it and rejoice in it. How many did not find the stable? To find it, we have to look for it. And to look for it, we have to want it. And it is this that we can change. What do you want, Christian? Really? Are your wants narrow as most people's are? Do you want to be approved by many others? Do you want to control and manipulate others so that you can be secure? Do you make fun of others so that you can feel superior? Do you suspect others so that you can feel protected, at least by the distance that you've put between you? Because really, you don't trust others. Or do you open yourself to God and to his people and change your wants to desiring what God ordains for you, not running from his truth and his will? And this happens in his people far more than we think, but embracing it in spite of our fears and learning what true faith is by living it. We don't know what faith is until it's hard to live, and we live it anyway. Most of the time, we don't live by faith because we make sure we don't have to. Because really, we're afraid to. But don't give in to those fears. Take a deep breath and move forward even into what frightens you and learn to live for God there. He won't let you down. He won't make it easy for you now, but he won't let you down either. Now, if God behaved himself as a good little God should, what occurs next in Nehemiah 4 would never have happened. Now, up to this point, you'll remember Nehemiah has organized the people of Jerusalem into masons and carters and lifters and quarrymen and all the support staff the builders would need, and things started well. And of course, being the people of God, God will make sure that things will continue to go well, that they will build the wall until the wall is completed. If they only have faith, if they believe the right things, God will make sure that all is well. Their lives would be busy but satisfying, their rest would be deep, their recreation fun and light and refreshing. Their friendships would be loyal and lasting, their work would be done each day, their clothes would not wear out, and their feet will not swell. After all, God did that for them in the Exodus, and God never changes, so that's what he'll do here on the wall as well. Except, of course, it didn't work out that way. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod heard that repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also, our enemies said, "Before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them, and we'll kill them and put an end to their work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest parts of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." Now, the first part of this, verses 7 through 12. Sanballat we've seen already, and Tobiah. He and Tobiah and Geshem were problems back in chapter 2. Against the building of the wall, they apparently wanted a weak Jerusalem, and therefore a weak Israel, so that they could rule a divided Judah. For you see, it's okay for Jews and Christians to be in some place, just as long as they behave themselves and do what we do and obey our culture and society. It's when they start acting differently that we become afraid enough to confront, and we hope to subdue them. Some things never change. Because they wanted a weak Jerusalem, they threatened to interpret their wall building as rebellion, a very serious accusation at the Persian court. And you will find that Nehemiah did not bend to them. And so, instead of going home, "These Jews are just too strong for us," they escalated their opposition. They started with the barrage of words we saw last Lord's Day at the beginning of chapter 4, ridiculing them to try to break their morale, parading an army before them to frighten them. "If I can make your fear stronger than mine, you'll back down and I will win, and I will no longer be afraid." We use each other in so many ways. And they did all of this so that they would not lose their power and prestige. Well, that didn't work either. So they had to think up something else. They bring in reinforcements. Now, in this part of chapter 4, they present to us the Ashdodites. The who? I'm glad you asked. Do you remember the Philistines, who were such a bother in Kings Saul and David's days? They lived in a line of 5 cities west and southwest of Jerusalem along the coast. Their cities were Gaza, Gath, Ekron, Ashkelon, and Ashdod. So these folks who now appear in Nehemiah 4 are descendants of old Philistia, the enemy of Judah. The almost unceasing war of Philistia against Judah was about 200 years ago by this time, and the Philistines never were much of a nation, more like a collection of like-minded and distantly related tribes. But old hatreds die hard sometimes, and the ruler of Ashdod apparently joined those already surrounding Jerusalem in opposing and harassing it. So the old Philistines, or at least their descendants, came back to join forces against them. So now they have Sanballat to the north, they have Tobiah to the west, they have Geshem the Arab to the south, and Ashdod to the west. They are completely surrounded and they are semi-besieged. Propagandists have known for a long time that if you just say something often enough, no matter how wrong or even how silly it is, something will stick in the mind. Welcome to the world of the TV and the iPod. Once we hear some assertion often enough, even if it's dumb, somebody will start asking, well, what if it's right? And the game of what if is a game with the wrong rules. Now, if you're doing research, what if may be right. If you're developing ethics, what if may be right. But if you're looking for moral truth, it's never right. And Judah, listening to these enemies with a vested personal interest in their failure, does it sound familiar? Judah begins to ask, what if they're right? And the result of that is seen here in Nehemiah 4. For a while, Sanballat and company looked as they really were. Shrill and dwarfish and ineffectual. They stood outside the gates and they made fun of the people inside, and Nehemiah didn't pay any attention to them. He said, we're going to keep building, and everybody realized that Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem couldn't do anything against them. They looked like what they were, a small group of schoolyard bullies shouting threats they could not carry out, because the sturdy faith and commitment of the Jerusalem builders shone a bright light on these enemies' actions and revealed their selfishness, and so for a while they were ignored. But these people didn't go away, and they kept it up, and kept it up. And eventually, some people on the wall began to listen to them, and their strength began to flag, because listening to enemies always undermines resolve, and resolve is the source of strength. So now Nehemiah finds that he has to deal with the heart and mind of the enemy inside as well as outside Jerusalem, because some of the enemy's ideas and thoughts now are inside the walls. And Judah, the people of God, have begun to think like their enemies. Do we really need to draw out this lesson? That we can't live near those who despise Christ? And there's a low-level despising that simply shrugs and says, well, if you want to believe that, it's fine, but it's not for me. That is still despising because it's still refusing Christ. That if we live near them, it would be hard for some of their attitude not to rub off on us. Do you see verse 12? In verse 12, you'll find it is those who are nearest the enemies who become most convinced of the futility of their work. Now, it didn't start in verse 12, of course. Nehemiah's straightforward piety and devoted vision had strengthened the builders through the first assaults, so that in verse 6, he simply says, so we built the wall until the whole thing reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. But then the enemies... And one might want to reflect on just why they were enemies. Judah hadn't attacked them. Judah just wanted to go home. The opposition was not a fair and good reaction to an injury. It was self-centered, calculating hatred, and that's all it was. Most of the people of the world do not like others who disagree with them, so they fight those who do. Being an enemy is part of their mindset, even if it isn't in others, the people they oppose. It only takes one person to be an enemy. And so it is here. Their enemies increase the ferocity of their attacks and decide to plot and fight, as it says, against them. What this leads to is a guess. Raids on trade into and out of the city, probably. That would put Jerusalem into almost into a state of siege and frighten some people. Saber rattling and encampments around the walls, surely. I mean, that's clear from the word. That would frighten some, too. Daily taunts and sly suggestions and a campaign of psychological warfare backed by spears and shields and swords. They obviously could not attack Jerusalem directly. There was the wall, and there were the defenders, and there were the king's letters that they knew about. They would forbid that. But they could discourage them. And that's what they did. The story here in Nehemiah 4 tells of growing unrest and misgivings. And as they listened to their enemies, the job began to look to them bigger and harder and worse every day. Misgivings and uncertainty are far more damaging than the presence of an enemy. For when the heart gives out and hope is gone, work and progress and improvement and growth all comes to a halt. And at least one of the sayings recorded here became so widespread that it took the form of a proverb. Verse 10 is actually in a Hebrew poetic form. It became so widespread that people just passed it as a truism from one to another. And it is introduced, "But Judah said." It seemed that almost everybody was saying this. "Will they finish in a day?" Sanballat had taunted them, and they had begun to believe it. "We really are too few, and the job is too big. We'll never finish this by ourselves." They were halfway through. A natural point for discouragement, actually. Most revolutions, historically, we find that most revolutions take place in countries in which things have begun to get better, not when they're at their worst. They were halfway through, a natural point for this discouragement, and they were tired. But fatigue wasn't their only worry. Who said verse 11? It does say, "Our enemies, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work." Okay, who said that? Yes, Sanballat and friends certainly started it, but who passed it on? What the Soviets used to call useful idiots, or willing conspirators, or the truly afraid? Christian, remember that when an enemy of Christ says something to you that is negative about you or your beliefs, there's a motive behind it, and the motive is rarely pure. If opposition to you is angry, the motive is never pure. Do not mistake this for a universal statement about all disagreements, because friends can disagree out of quite pure motives, and therefore they should be heard. But these people were not friends. They were enemies. They made themselves enemies without any provocation, which most enemies will do. No matter what an enemy says, his words will have an effect only if we listen. We must receive those words for them to do their work. Like Eve before the tree, we have to see that the fruit really does have some good points, and then we'll tell ourselves that, well, maybe it's all good points. And as soon as we start playing with these ideas, we decide, for there is a decision here, to follow those ideas. Be careful of the ideas you toy with. Oh, ask lots of questions. Face questions and disagreements. Don't be afraid of grappling with different ideas, but recognize that enemies are a different matter, and of their words and ideas, be very careful. These people weren't, and so they lost heart and hope, and Nehemiah had to stop the work completely and set the people as an army, not just an armed guard or an escort, around the wall. He gave them time to watch and guard and see just how strong the enemy really is. And no attack came. They waited, and nothing happened. Just as the enemy was enemy from within their own hearts, the people's fears came from within theirs. Nehemiah gave them time to stand and rest and watch and observe and finally to see the truth. No, the enemy is not so strong that they will be overcome. And finally, rested, they began to see that the wall was not so huge that they could not finish it. They'd already built it halfway. They could finish the rest of it, too. Where the wall was lowest and weakest, Nehemiah gathered them by families and made them strong. And what else are we but a family? And what are we to be together but strong? And if we stop and look at each other and think about what we've done together, you will see how we support and help and strengthen each other. Do you see verses 19 and 20? In 19 and 20, it says, "Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, 'The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us.'" Do you do that on a Sunday? What did Nehemiah say to them in verse 14? They'd been looking at the enemy, and at the fallen debris, and at the ruined wall, and they became discouraged. Nehemiah reminded them to look at God. What had he done for them so far? He's brought them to this point, the halfway point. They are protected, and they are greater than they feared. They are so great that the threatening enemy cannot attack, doesn't dare to attack, not when they're together. Remember, the one frame of mind God again and again calls us to have is, what is it really? What is the absolute truth? That's what Nehemiah is doing. When you are discouraged, he says to his friends, it's because you're not seeing something that's very necessary and very real. He reminded them why they were there. Fight for your families and your homes, he said. We're not building the wall for Jerusalem. We're building it for you and for your families. You're building it to protect the ones you love and who depend on you. Why do you do what you do? Do you do what you do to make money or to provide for your family? Anybody can do that. That's merely the social acceptable role. Important as it is, and there's no doubt that it's important, it's nothing more than anyone else can do or anyone else does. But do you teach and counsel and change? For we all need to change for their sake too. Do you not just provide for them as everybody else does, but do you change for them as they need you to? Do you watch them and listen to them so that you find out what they need and then become that? Not just do that, but become that? What you are now is not what you need to be tomorrow, Christian. Change. Be changing. Be growing for the sake of your family, both in your home and in your church. Nehemiah knew that the people on the wall could not fight their battles alone. He got everyone else ready to come to their defense if an attack came against them. I think I've told you about the Pusan perimeter in 1950. My dad said that he was at a party about the middle of 1950. And the host of the party, a colonel, got a telephone call. And when he hung up the phone, he turned to the rest of them and said, the North Koreans have crossed the 38th parallel. Everybody knew what that meant. And so these people, so many of them who'd been in World War II, were going to have to go back to war. Well, the North Koreans flooded South Korea and pushed all the defenders down to this little defensive ring down at the very southern tip of Korea, around the city of Pusan. And there were just too many attackers. The Marines knew that they were going to have to go. What the Marine Corps did was to scratch together what they called a regimental combat team and sent them over, and they were a flying plug in the dike. Wherever the North Koreans attacked, that's where the Marines went. Now, Dad wasn't part of that. Dad, later on, was part of the landing at Incheon, where they landed behind them. But for a while, what Nehemiah asked and had his people do, that's exactly what the Marines had to do in 1950. Because there were too many around them, they brought in some who, wherever the trumpet sounded, that's where they went, and that's how they defended Pusan and each other. They worked for each other, even though some of them were just army. They were together. They were working together. It didn't matter what was on the collar. They were together. And that's what Nehemiah did so many hundreds of years ago around Jerusalem. Christian, don't ever say that you don't need anyone else. That way always lies defeat. It may be through pride or fear or both that we say that, but that way always lies defeat. Anyone who does not seek aid and help and fellowship and advice has the wrong idea of being a Christian. None of us stands alone. And the healthy child of God knows that he can't do it alone. And it takes more than a fearful decision to let God do it without any effort of ours. And it does often come from fear. And not to seek out helpful friends. If you do it by yourself, you won't do it at all. God made you part of his family to help and to be helped, not only to look out for those who are wavering and you come to their defense, but also sometimes when you stumble and stagger, and you will, to let others be a help to you too. Do both. It's the only way to be healthy. Be ready to come to another's aid, and be ready to ask for it too. In fact, look at verse 22, where he says, "At that time, I also said to the people, 'Have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve as guards by night and workmen by day.' Even Nehemiah asked for help." There's a very simple recipe for being miserable. Live for yourself, make your own decisions, and ask for no help. Go your own way. And as C.S. Lewis said in his book, The Four Loves, you will be as safe as a corpse in its coffin. How involved are you in others' lives? How deeply do you let others touch you? How open and honest are you with others? How well can you ask for help? How willing are you to help, not to be the hero, but to be a help? Helping, when helping means giving up your rights, are you willing to do that? Because that is when we are the church. Amen.